Socks on 35th is next. Doors open on the left.
How's it going, everybody? My name is Duke Coughlin, and welcome to the Socks on 35th podcast. We are back with another exciting episode covering your Chicago White Sox. I'm actually joined by different people this time, except for Jordan Lazowski, who I'm always joined by. But I am also joined by the friendly neighborhood Socks on 35th prospect guy, Michael Suero. Gentlemen, how are we doing today?
Michael, good to see you. My pet peeve is when you listen to podcasts, we're like, how's everyone doing? And it's like, I'm good. I've decided it's not going to start this time because I just decided it like 30 seconds ago. I've decided I'm going to have some sort of contemplative thought or thought-provoking something ready for us when we do these podcasts from now on. Because I'm tired of saying I'm good. Like, even though it's true, I'm good. Like, I'm going to give people more than that moving forward. So, Michael, good to have you on.
Well, Laz, we're actually waiting for what you just described. So by all means, fill us in.
No, I said next time. I came up with the idea too recently. I have nothing planned for it. So
all that build up just for a big old nothing burger. Disgusting.
Just going to keep the listeners coming back.
Oh, man. I was curious to see what you're going to say. But
it's still contemplative. Think about it. Like every time you listen to a podcast, everyone always says, I'm good. Give me a little something more. That's what I'm trying to hope to get to.
So, Michael, are you doing bad today?
Well, I was going to say I'm doing good, but how can I say that?
But see,
now?
It's just the natural response. See, this was something contemplative. I'm hoping people are now thinking about it.
Well, you all came onto the Socks on 35th podcast to think today.
And damn it, I'm making you do it.
We're certainly thinking something, pleasant or not. Wow, you really threw me off my loop. All right, so
good.
That's like my go-to. Well, we have a lot to cover. I mean, as much as we can cover with spring training, but Michael actually released some pretty good stuff as far as some prospects goes. But before we get started in all that, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out the website, socksdown35th.com, as well as following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram when Facebook and Instagram are working at socksdown35th. God, Laz, you really threw me off. All right.
Man, I really threw you off.
You did. You know, we've done how many episodes together? We have this formulaic system that we do every single time. The listeners come back just to hear that intro, just to hear how good we're all doing. And you have thrown everybody for a loop, man. It's good. March, and you might have already ruined people's years just good. with your nonsense. My goodness.
I'm in mid-season form. You guys are all in spring training. I am in mid-season form, gentlemen.
Well, anyway, Eloy Jimenez looks really good. I think we should talk about that. In all seriousness, though, I'm a big Eloy Jimenez guy. So coming from me, it's always going to sound a little more hyped up than it probably should be. But in all honesty, I think Eloy Jimenez has earned quite a bit of hype here in spring training. Has been absolutely crushing baseballs. Even the ones that aren't going over the walls are getting hit as just absolute missiles. He's been driving in a lot of runs. His approach at the plate looks a lot better. Obviously this is the time of the year where guys kind of work stuff out. Laz has already talked too much, so I don't want to hear from him. Michael, how do you feel about Eloy Jimenez so far throughout spring training?
Yeah, I mean, it's only spring training, so we can't put too much stock into it yet, right? But I mean, this is the Eloy that we should be expecting. This is the type of hitter that we all knew he was capable of being. We just haven't really seen it throughout a full season yet. But I mean, he's off to a great start. He's someone that I've still always been a big believer in. If he could just stay healthy and stay on the field, he should be probably the best hitter on the team, honestly, with his power and his hitting ability. But no, it's great to see him get off to such a good start in spring training, and hopefully he can carry it into the season. You know, him, you know, finally having that breakout year, I think would be huge for this team. I know the expectations aren't crazy high right now, but having that middle of the order bat that he's capable of being would go a long way this season.
I think it even goes a step further than that too. Health is one thing, absolutely, but it's always going to be, is he going to hit 45 to 50% ground balls or not. And I think a lot of people have started mentioning it. He has made some sort of swing change. His hands are starting higher in his swing. Hopefully that leads to an improved bat path to where he's not swinging down on the ball. I think his home run against the Dodgers on Wednesday is hopefully the best example of what that could be. Lower in the zone, if you've got a choppy downward swing, you're going to beat that ball into the ground. He's done that hundreds of times over the past couple seasons. I think that was the first swing that, yeah, you don't want to buy too much into spring training hype. We've all made that mistake before. But that at least had me encouraged that there could be legitimate changes for him heading into this season. And it's simply because it's either he gets the bat on a plane to where he's not hitting it into the ground 50% of the time, or he doesn't. I think health is absolutely part of the equation, but I want to go a step beyond that too. And I'm hoping this is the change that leads to it.
Aloy has always kind of had that power stroke. And obviously, you know, it's always been like what we've seen in small sample sizes. That's always been great. You know, can he play 160, you know, can he play 150 games? So like, let's start there. Can he play a full season? Health is always going to be the number one thing with him. But more than anything, I just want to see more consistency, because, you know, you'll see his final stat line and you can look at his per 162, and that per 162 always looks like just one of the best hitters in baseball, genuinely. But what needs to come with it is we need to see it on a more consistent basis. We can't have these hot and cold streaks like we've had in the past. And I'll even go as far back to like his original run as a rookie. You know, we saw that when he was healthy, when he was playing, it was consistent. There was power. He was hitting it. He was hitting it everywhere. There was as good discipline at the plate as you're going to get with a guy like Aloy. And I really think there is the potential there with adjustments and potentially getting a new hitting coach in his ear that maybe this is the season, if he stays healthy, that he can really figure out and build consistency. Like, I don't want to take too much out of spring training, but what I've seen early on has been insanely promising. And, you know, Michael, you brought up the point about low expectations. I think that is the best thing in the world. And even Gavin Sheets touched on it when he was on here a couple weeks ago. That is the best thing to hone into if you're a Chicago White Sox right now. Nobody's expecting anything out of you. This like boys club idea where there's like these friends and cliques in the locker room, that's kind of dead. Like, guys are out here playing for their job, proving they belong in Major League Baseball. And, you know, selfishly or not, if they think that's with the White Sox or not, I don't think that's on the mind of some of these guys. I think they're just in the mindset that, like, whether or not it's with the White Sox, I need to prove that I'm a major league level hitter and I can be consistent and I can play on a day-to-day basis. And that's the biggest thing I want to see out of Aloy Jimenez coming into this year. But it is spring training, so it's really hard to kind of build too much off of that. But I mean, even on the flip side of that, you know, you look at a guy like Garrett Crochet, who in the small sample size that we've seen him so far in spring, looks kind of similar to that first glimpse of Garrett Crochet. Maybe not with the velocity, but looks like a guy who can be flat out dominant, has really improved his pitch sequencing from what we've seen in the past, and looks like a guy who's pitching with a lot of confidence. Everybody in the league wants a power lefty starter. I think it's just that type of thing to kind of have in your back pocket that really throws batters for a loop. But Laz, I'll let you start with this. How are you feeling about Garrett Crochet as a potential starter? Do you think that's something that can be kind of built up? Do you think that's something that the Sox try early? Where do you feel about Garrett Crochet right now?
I'll never be convinced until he does it, simply because he started a game but threw an inning or two innings. Until he's out there 4, 5, 6 innings, I won't fully buy into it, just because it's been so long since he's been drafted. And that's not anything that's necessarily his fault. It's how the White Sox chose to handle him for a time. We almost have to accept that this is what it is. He does have a minor league option, so the Sox could theoretically send him down to AAA, have him throw 5 innings every 5 days, and turn himself into a starter and see if it works, see if it doesn't work. I'm not there yet. The stuff looks great, but I'm not there yet in terms of being a starter, because it's just one of those things. You have to show that you can do it. Everyone says they're a starter when they're coming up through high school and college, and eventually guys end up flaming out, or their stuff just plays better in the bullpen. I don't know where that falls for Crochet yet. A third offering that isn't the fastball and slider becomes an important part of this equation. I know everyone likes to say two-pitch pitchers are fine, not in this day and age. So if you can find that third offering, we'll see what happens. I'll go with cautiously optimistic. It will be my word.
I think cautiously optimistic is a completely fair way to describe our feelings on Crochet right now. And I also do completely agree. He needs to add a third pitch because two-pitch pitchers can be dominant relievers, but they're not going to make it too long as starters. You know, before spring training, when they were talking about putting him in the rotation, you brought it up already that he's got that minor league option. I thought that putting him in AAA for most, if not the entire season, to let him build his arm back up, thought maybe that was going to be the way to go. But he's looking pretty damn good right now in spring training, and they have so many starting pitching options right now that I almost wonder, he's not going to throw 120 innings this year. That's just not going to happen. So you're going to have to find a way to start to get him stretched out, start to get him on that regular starting pitcher routine while still, you know, knowing that his arm needs to be built up. I wonder if there's a world where you almost make him an opener this year, maybe let him pitch 1, 2, 3 innings, you know, kind of build that up a little bit as the season goes on, and then have someone piggyback off of him. Like, I don't know, I personally, I'd say Nick Destrini, but just someone who is, you know, fighting for one of those last rotation spots. You got all these starting pitching options, including Crochet. It's just another way to get more of them on the MLB roster and kind of start to get creative with your rotation. I don't know if that's something Grifol's going to consider. It's something I think maybe he should, because it allows him to pitch every fifth game. It's not going to be crazy on his arm where they're asking him to throw a ton of innings this year. And it just at least starts that transition to him being a starter. You know, you can get him more innings as the season goes on. Maybe you end up cutting him off somewhere, giving him a pitch or an inning limit. But it at least gets that transition started to next year. You can start to make him more of a full-time starting pitcher.
I think there's a world in which the White Sox just look at him and say, dude, you want to be a starter long-term or not? Like, yeah, you're still young, but you're not as young as when we drafted you. And in order to truly make you a starter, you're going to have to throw every 5 days. So do you want to do that in the minors and really get on that schedule? Or, Michael, your option of be an opener, 2 or 3 innings at a time, and then we go from there. There needs to be a world, I think, still in which he gets a chance to throw 5-inning starts. Or, hey, he really pushes it up to 6 innings. Maybe that comes the second half of the year when they've traded off some of their assets, if there are any to trade off, and they end up needing to fill spots again. I think there's a world in which, yeah, you say, okay, well, he was an opener till July. Now the next 2 months, you know, we're going to have to shut him down early, but before we shut him down early from this innings limit, we're going to let him be a starter and go 4, 5, 6 innings. Maybe it's only 3 starts he gets, but it's still better than nothing. I'm not necessarily there yet on that. I think it's fine to do that simply because this team, again, reminder, this team sucks. So it's not a bad thing to try it at the major league level. I think the lower pressure environment of doing it in AAA might be more appealing. I struggle figuring out what's the best way to make an attempt at it. I'm 100% on board with making an attempt at it. I'm just still struggling with the best way to make an attempt at it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm essentially going to mirror a lot of what you guys said. You know, I really do like Garrett Crochet. I think the talent is there. You know, I think there's a lot of raw talent there. And I think we saw that early on in his career, but I'm with you guys. I need him to do what he did in this small sample size in spring training. I need him to do that for 5, 6 innings. Like I want it to be a gradual ramp up, because I think when you have a guy who hasn't thrown that type of innings, especially with the injury history that he's had the last few years, we really can't rush an arm getting adjusted to going from pitching an inning here and there or pitching out of the bullpen to jumping right into like 5-6 innings. So if it's something where the Sox wanted to do an opener type role, like you guys were like talking about, I'd be open to it, but I would side more with the idea that he doesn't go to AAA. Like if he wants to be a starter, he needs innings. It's as simple as that. It's just, it's just the science behind being able to ramp up your arm without just severely putting yourself in the way of potential injury. That, and, you know, even to the third pitch point that you guys made, I really think even a small variation of his fastball or slider could go a long way. He just can't be showing the exact same type of pitch just in different areas when you only have two pitches. You know, like you said, Laz, in modern day baseball, with how smart hitters have gotten, how much data hitters have gotten from pitchers, there needs to be more unpredictability of what he's going to give you in every situation. And until I can see him do that past the first time through the order, or even past the second time through the order, very skeptical about the idea of trying to force him into that role this season as a on the major league roster. You know, I don't care if we're good or bad. There's a lot of guys who are ramped up to throw those types of innings that we can get a good look at, while Garrett Crochet works to that through AAA. And, you know, we've seen it with pitchers on other teams, pitchers in the past. You know, I think actually Corbin Burns, which is somebody I bring up a lot, because I think if you look at the adjustments the Brewers made to him before he became the dominant starter that he was, I think that plays into what a lot of teams are looking at with guys like this. He needs to build up, you know, confidence be damned. You know, if he wants to be a starter, start him in AAA. And if by the halfway point he's throwing good innings, he looks good, he looks comfortable, he doesn't have any arm pain, then maybe you give him a shot to maybe spot start here and there. But I don't want to hit this situation like a Jimmy Lambert where we're popping him up back and forth, and then he just ends up, you know, as a spot starter or a doubleheader starter, just end up being a full-time bullpen guy, because what did we really accomplish at that point? So I want to see the Sox get away from what they've done with starting pitchers in the past. Just send Grochet down to AAA. Let him absolutely kill it in AAA. Let him be the best starting pitcher in AAA. I don't care. Like, he needs to be able to build that up, because otherwise you're just going to risk another serious injury. And I don't think Garrett Crochet's career can handle that.
I think I might have talked myself into, and this is 30 seconds ago, a minute ago, Duke, I would have completely agreed. I think I actually talked myself into Michael's idea. 20 starts of 3 innings each through the first however many months of the season that get you to the trade deadline. You trade off your assets. You let them make 3 or 4 more starts, get them to 80, 85 innings. And I think that's probably the number everybody's looking for. That accomplishes the task of he throws every 5 days. That accomplishes the task of he throws for the majority of the season. Because if he starts as a starter and is now 5-6 innings every start, starting in maybe April or maybe mid-April, early May, the season's going to end sooner for him. So if you want him to get the idea of throwing every 5 days but do it over the course of a season, he'll be done in like July or August, versus being able to extend it a little bit longer if you throw fewer innings, but throw every 5 days. And maybe you build it up to where, I mean, it's going to be guys like Jared Schuster or Chris Flexen. I know some people like Schuster or Flexen. I don't feel the need to prioritize their innings over Crochet. So if it's a scenario where Crochet's dealing and you want to change those 3 innings into 4 and 5 innings here and there, I'm open to that idea too.
So to bounce that back at you, you brought up innings. Are you an innings or a pitch count guy?
Innings. He needs to physically get up and down off the mound as many times as possible. 45 to 50 pitches a start early on, in terms of if they were to do something like an opener. Then you maybe extend that to 60 and then push it to 75 as the season goes on, versus having to feel like he has to start at 4 or 5 innings very early on when you're still trying to get him in the routine of throwing every 5 days. I think most teams will look at it from the standpoint of how many times is he getting up and down, because there's fatigue in continuing to get up and down every single time. that I think has to be worked into the idea of making him a long-term starter. But yeah, that's my long-winded way of saying they're kind of related, but innings primarily because there's going to be a limit on that.
Okay, that about answers the question I was looking for, because I feel like a lot of people get hyper-focused on one or the other, and I think the up and down point is a very important one. For those who don't know, that's why you see pitchers wearing, you know, wearing a sweatshirt in 80-degree weather during the summer. It's because they want to stay warm. You know, it's as simple as that.
It's a fatigue thing, too. It's like, if he's throwing close, like, there are reports he's throwing 100 right now. I don't know if that's going to happen when he gets back to Chicago. That's a completely different thing. But that's a max effort delivery. And this sounds like a scouting report when he was coming out of college. This is a max effort delivery. Can you fit? Can your body physically handle you doing that 150 innings a year, 150 up and downs a year? I don't know yet. I think it almost lends itself to say, let's slowly add on to this and see if at any point you kind of max out. If you max out and you can't get past that fourth inning and you're only at 55, 60, 70 pitches maybe at that point, you're probably not cut out for it at that point. It's not because of anything you could have done differently. It's just a max effort delivery as frequent as possible.
It's another really good point.
There's so many different angles to it. That's why I continue to build myself into the category of opener, three innings, and then slowly increase that and slowly increase that. You can do that at the AAA level too, honestly. I wouldn't hate that. He's been at the major league level for a while now, and he shows he belongs. So if you can accomplish the same thing for a crappy major league team, I'm not against that.
To the Corbin Burns point that I made a little bit earlier, Corbin was a very good bullpen piece for the Brewers before they ended up sending him down to AAA to really learn how to be a starter. And that's my biggest argument, I guess, to make sure that he does start on AAA, because, you know, like you said, he does belong, but he belongs out of the bullpen. We need to be able to see that he belongs as a starter if that's what he's going to try to do. And I think the best way you're going to be able to learn that is when you don't have as much major league pressure on you to be able to kind of effectively try things, be able to kind of get away from that, like that full force delivery you were talking about, which was a great point. And it's something people don't talk about a lot, is how different pitchers pitch when they know they're going to pitch an inning or two compared to when they're going to pitch seven. You know what I mean? There's huge difference in that. And there have been a lot of guys who started in the bullpen, even like a Pedro Martinez, if I'm talking like a strong example here, starting out of the bullpen to start his career and then easing back into a starting role. He lost probably like 2-3 miles per hour velocity off his fastball, but being able to ramp that back up without completely changing his rotation of how he pitches and using a little less stress on his arm to be able to throw those pitches, it can be done. It's not necessarily impossible, but it is something that needs to be focused on if he wants to be a long-term starter.
The only other thing I'll say, and I don't like making this argument, but I think it's a factor and I want to mention it, service time. He would be a free agent currently after 2026. Could you extend it a year and either as a starter or as an opener at the minor league level all year and extend that out one more year? There's that argument to be made too. I don't think it should be the priority necessarily, but if this ends up working, I'd rather have 3 years of him than two.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be a priority, but, you know, baseball is also a business, so it very well could be in the back of their minds that they could squeeze out an extra year of him. And in all honesty, based on the way this year is going to go, I don't care too much whether he starts in the majors or in AAA. Personally, I think either way, the opener idea is still a good one that would fit for him. Just like you said, Laz, he's getting him through more of a full season is, I think, what should be a priority. Getting him to throw the ball every fifth game from April through at least August. Getting him into that routine so that he can almost just like a way to ease him into getting to that full on starting rotation job for next year, if that works out. But regardless, I just think getting him up and down on and off the mound every inning, getting him the ball every fifth game, I think those should be the top two priorities.
Really, I guess in closing, I would say it's a very delicate process that needs to be monitored and coached correctly. They need to be giving him the right things to be looking for, from making that transition to throwing hard as absolute piss to easing up a little bit so he can last a bit longer in a game. And that's putting a lot of trust into the White Sox developmental system. But at the same time, our Chris Getz came from the developmental system, so maybe that's more of a focus now. I don't know. This is going to be something that really needs to be watched and monitored. It's going to be really interesting to see how, A, this final roster builds up, and B, how guys who are sent to AAA or AA are handled moving forward, because we can't really see a lot of the same of what we've seen the last couple of years. We just can't. We're at a point, and you know, this kind of brings me into the next thing here is, you know, even long-term starters, they end up dealing with serious injuries, and it can end up hindering their careers. You know, overuse, the development of them, it can really, really throw off their entire algorithm. You know, and you look at a guy like Lucas Giolito, who just signed with Boston, had a bit of a bumpy road last year with a couple of stops that he made after the Angels trade, and now really tough start to his season, in a season where he was going to have to kind of prove himself that he was still that top level type of pitcher, you know, that he kind of hinted at when he was here. With that, what do you think this does for the market of, say, like a Dylan Cease?
So, first of all, it sucks that we're talking about a Lucas Giolito injury. You know, even though he's not on the team anymore, he's just such a beloved pitcher in the city, and hate to see that happen to such a good pitcher and a good guy. So I hate that we're even talking about his injury as making a point for the way the Sox are handling other players. I think what it affects more is, should the Sox have more urgency now after seeing some of these injuries happen? Should Chris Getz be looking at this saying, yeah, I mean, I knew there was, you know, risk, you know, if we hold on to Dylan Cease, but seeing it happen to other teams now, maybe it's getting too real. Maybe you start to ease up on what you're willing to take in a trade package for Cease to make sure that you're getting anything at all for him, versus, you know, come May, something happens and all of a sudden he has zero trade value. That's the worst possible case scenario for the White Sox here. And if the reports about what they're getting offered for Cease are true, I totally get why Getz hasn't pulled the trigger on a trade offer yet. But it's just, it's getting a little too real, seeing some of these injuries and being like, that could happen to the White Sox, and then their only real trade chip all of a sudden is worthless, and their next core, their farm system, is kind of stuck where it's at currently, which isn't in a bad spot anymore, but it's kind of in that almost middle ground. It definitely has a lot of room for improvement if you can bring in some new high-end prospects. So I don't know. I think that Getz should be taking a long, hard look at this situation and starting to think about whether or not he should have a little more urgency in trading him.
Yeah, that's the hard part too. It's because I don't think this makes either team desperate enough to make a move. The Red Sox were going to be bad anyway, and I don't think they're willing to sink more capital, it's not money in this case, it'd be just team capital, into what they already think is not a winning team. So I don't think it makes the Red Sox desperate. I don't think it makes the Cardinals desperate yet. I think they have shown that they are prepared. They're the central in the NL. Someone's got to win that stupid division. I don't think anyone's ready to make a play for that, kind of like the AL Central's the exact same way. The problem is the flip side of, oh yeah, pitchers can get hurt whenever. That's right. I forgot about that over the offseason. It's a huge failure if he gets hurt and they don't trade him. The problem is we don't know what teams are offering. It becomes the consistent question I have been on it all offseason. You need to trade him. You need to trade him. You need to trade him. But if the offers really are that bad, I can see why he continues to take the risk. Man, is it getting bigger and bigger by the day, though. Every time he takes the mound, it's a huge risk. I don't know. I continue to go back and forth on it all. I have always been very much in the camp of trade him as soon as you get something near good value, because every single other time he's out there throwing a baseball, you're kind of stuck if something doesn't happen the way you want it to. I don't know. That was a very non-answer, but I don't think it's going to make teams desperate enough to move him. I think if anything, Michael, to your point, this is a reminder that Chris Getz, you better get this right, for lack of a better term.
That's what makes it so difficult, is you're playing a really thin line. And this is why, you know, it's easy for us to sit in our living rooms as we're watching baseball games and criticize a guy like Chris Getz. But like, there is so much positives and negatives to each side of the coin here, you know, because if you don't hold off and you take a bad trade, okay, you just gave away your best piece besides Luis Robert, who realistically isn't getting traded. I don't even know. That's an entirely different discussion. But again, one of your blue chip players. And then on the flip side of that, if you wait too long, Dylan Cease comes hobbling off the mound. Like, either way, it's like a lose-lose, but you need to find a way to win in a lose-lose, which is such an incredibly hard thing to do. Not to give Chris Getz too much like slack here, but man, that's a very tough decision. I think that's something a lot of GMs really, like, people don't realize GMs have to deal with. But moving on, we talked a lot about pitching. And honestly, boys, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I'm alone here. Laz, I can attest to you, Michael, of that, but I could talk pitching all day. I love the science, the mindset, everything that goes into pitching, and so many nuances that go with each individual player, each individual role. And you know, I think Michael, actually, you've actually kind of proven yourself as far as on the developmental side to really be somebody that kind of has a really good focus on something like that. Kind of just jumping right in here. You know, and we've discussed a lot of spring training, but on the prospect side of the things, who have you seen, or what have you seen from some of the Sox farm system who has maybe gotten an opportunity to play a little bit more, besides, you know, hold your breath on Tim Elko? Like, we can all praise Tim Elko all day. I could talk about Tim Elko for 3 fucking hours. What have you seen early on from the prospects?
Yeah. Trade Vaughn. Tim Elko is my opening day first baseman. It's set in stone. Let's do it. He's been on a tear, but in reality, so spring training, honestly, I've really liked what we've seen out of some of these relief pitching prospects that we've got. Jordan Leisure, Prelander Baroa. These guys have some electric stuff, and neither one of them's guaranteed an opening day roster job, but man, both of them are really competing for it. They both kind of have similar, you know, profiles too. They both have, you know, high velocity fastball, you know, wipeout sliders. Both of them have high leverage relief pitcher upside too. So it's really nice to see both of them with little to no MLB experience show up in spring training. Again, like I said before with Eloy, it's spring training, hold it with a grain of salt, but both of them are off to some promising starts, I'd say. And then the other one that I gotta throw a shout out to, more for his defense than anything, but Brian Ramos kind of looks like a MLB ready defensive third baseman. I know he's had one or two miscues throughout spring training, but for the most part, you know, he looks like he's got the range over there. He's got more than enough of an arm there. I know early on in his minor league tenure, there were talks about, you know, could he outgrow the spot? Could he eventually have to move over to a corner outfield position? But then as he progressed, he was even, you know, pitching in a little bit at second base down in the minors. So there's been some good reports about his defensive abilities, but it's really nice to see it show up in an actual game setting, to where I don't think there's any questions about him defensively. And, you know, we know that he's a solid hitter. So it just gets me more excited about the possibility of him being our long-term third baseman.
Don't mention Leisure and Baroa too much. I've got some dynasty drafts coming up, and don't mention them too much. I need people to sleep on them. Ramos is a different story, but you know, with all of this prospect talk, some of these guys, actually all three of those guys, were mentioned in your top 30 prospect list. It was prospect week at Sox and 35th last week. You listed out honorable mention pitchers, honorable mention position players, and then the top 30. Explain your evaluation process a little bit, Michael, just because, you know, you've done these for quite a bit of time now. I don't think anyone's ever really stopped to ask, because everyone has their own little style on things. Everyone's lists. Yeah, everyone has Colson Montgomery at the top. Yeah, I can put him there, too. I think there's a level of analysis that I'm curious to where you end up settling when you look back. You're like, here's how I built this list.
Yeah, so to start off, I think in general, I think there's kind of a pretty good consensus about who are the probably top seven prospects in this farm system are. Like you said, Colson's number one, and then Schultz is clear-cut number two. Then you've got a group of three after them in Ramos, Quiro, and Nastrini, who you could pretty much rank those three in any order, but those are pretty firmly your three through five. And then most would agree that Jake Eder and Jacob Gonzalez are probably six and seven. And then after that is where the evaluations come. And after that, you could go in 20 million different directions, I'd say. For me, there's on top of other aspects as well, but there's really two big factors that I look at for when I'm doing my prospect evaluations, and they kind of play off each other. But, you know, I look at, you know, a prospect's production versus their projection. And then I also look at their production compared to their age and the level of competition that they're facing. So first off, the production versus projection, try saying that five times fast. So I'll look at, you know, you mentioned Tim Elko earlier. I'll look at his, you know, production and say, okay, well, he's crushing in the lower levels. Like, is that sustainable? Or I'll look at, on the flip end, someone like Jake Eder, whose production was kind of trash last year, let's face it. But I still think people are giving up way too early on him, because you're not factoring in the fact that he missed all of 2022 with Tommy John surgery. His 2023 season got off to a late start because of a foot injury. So he didn't have any sort of off-season or preseason process. He kind of just jumped into a month or month and a half into the season, and was just well behind everyone else because he didn't get that ramp up period. So it's not overly surprising that he had that slump of a season. So it's just kind of putting the numbers into more context, like, okay, like, this guy did really well. Is it sustainable? Or this guy kind of sucked, but was there more at play? Was it bad luck? Were there other contributing factors? Like, does he still have the stuff to bounce back? Which, again, I'll go back to Jake Eder. He's got awesome stuff, so he absolutely does. But that's kind of the first thing that I look at is, you know, what they're doing now compared to what they legitimately could be doing a year or two from now. And then the other part of it, like I said, production based on their age and level of competition. That's something that I really value in a prospect. You know, you if you're a 24-year-old pitcher and you're dominating in low A Kannapolis, I'm not going to put too much stock into that, because you're older than the average level of competition. You should be more advanced. You should be dominating that level. I want to see what you can do when you get called up to double A, if you can still sustain those numbers. And then on the flip end of it, you know, you guys know I was a big Christian Mana fan, mainly because of what he was doing at 20 years old in double A. Was he lights out? No. Was he holding his own while being significantly younger than the rest of the competition? Yes. That's why I still had him before he was traded in my top 10. And that's why I still have Edgar Quiro as my third overall prospect, because, yeah, he only had a 105 WRC plus last year, but he did it at 20 years old in double A after skipping high A entirely. So it just, the context of those numbers, he shouldn't have been able to still sustain average to above average numbers based on that scenario. But he still did it, and he still did it while, you know, walking nearly the same amount that he was striking out. Like, for a 20-year-old against more advanced pitching, That's impressive. So it's just kind of taking factors like that. That's how those are just two of the biggest, you know, factors that I have in my evaluation, because I think that is very telling of not only where prospects are at currently, but where their upside realistically is and how much they can grow after that.
Predictability and production, I like the idea of having to balance the two. I think that's a fair evaluation of it. I think everyone's going to agree or disagree on predictability. That's the hard part. That's why people get paid the big bucks. And that's where we're going to put some of the pressure on you with some of these questions. Great. In terms of projecting how this season could go for a couple of guys. I think, you know, you go through the list, you probably wrestle with guys here and there. Who is anyone in the bottom half of your list that you could really see making a rise in 2024, more so like 15 and below? And then any honorable mentions you feel like, hey, by the end of this season, come, I'm doing this again in 2025. Here's a name that you should expect to see on this list.
So I'm going to start off with the guy who was in my honorable mention, because I really wrestled with whether or not I should include him in my top 30. I was honestly, he was very close to cracking number 30 for me. Mason Adams, he is a guy who he is showing up on a lot of other top 30 lists. And I completely understand why. Actually, MLB Pipeline has him 19th. So people smarter than me have him ranked higher than I do. But he's a guy that I absolutely think could and should be cracking this list by midseason. I think he's an excellent pitcher. He's got great command of all his pitches. He's got an absolute hammer of a curveball. His fastball sits in the low 90s, and he's got a usable changeup and a slider, but the curveball is really his calling card, and then his ability to pound the strike zone is really good. But it goes back to, you know, what I personally value in prospects is that production versus age and level competition. I mean, he only had 6 starts above, you know, low A Kannapolis, and his showing in like 80 something innings in Kannapolis was strong. His ERA was in the 2s. He wasn't walking anyone. He looked awesome. A few starts in Winston-Salem at high A. Again, he was looking pretty damn good. He did run into a bit of a snag in his final 3 starts when he did get called up to Birmingham. And that's where I don't want to say I knocked him a little bit, but that's just part of why I didn't put him in my top 30 was he didn't pitch enough above that low A level. And, you know, when he finally did get to a level that was more age appropriate for him, I mean, he's going to be entering the season at 24 years old. He did run into a bit of a rough stretch. Now, it wasn't bad, but it just, his walk rate went up, his strikeouts went down, ERA blew up a little bit. I want to see him be more consistent at that more advanced level before I have him crack the top 30, which I absolutely think he could and should do by midseason. And then for the guy that showed up in my bottom, in the bottom half of my top 30, I'm going to butcher his name, but we'll give it a shot. I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Javier Mogollon.
Definitely don't ask Duke, but I don't know either. I'll take your word for
that's,
it.
That's just rude. That's just rude.
I was literally looking before this podcast. I was literally looking up like his pronunciation and found zero help.
Yeah, I don't know, but I know for a fact that Duke doesn't know. That's all I can help you with.
You know what, Laz? I won my spelling bee in 4th and 5th grade, so you can just go ahead and eat it.
He's a pro. I mean, come on. Those are credentials.
You're right. You're right. I'm sorry.
But anyways, that guy, Mogollon, I think I got it right. So he's a guy that kind of came out of nowhere last year. We signed him for like $75,000 out of the Dominican Republic, and he was in the Dominican Summer League all last season. And even before the season started, he was a guy that guys like Ben Badler of Baseball America were pointing out, saying like, if you're looking for under the radar international prospects, like this is a guy to keep an eye on. Well, all he did in his first professional season was hit 10 home runs, steal double-digit bases, hit over 300, and I'm, I I think I got this right. I think pretty sure he walked twice as much as he struck out. So like his walk rate was at like 10% and his strikeout rate was only like 5. It was, he put up crazy numbers at that level. He was clearly one of the best players in the Dominican Summer League. And this wasn't a situation like Lloyd Ulchepe, where he was $500,000 signing, was already 21 years old when he came over and was just pouncing on, lower level competition, and he kind of leveled off once he came stateside and was in, low A and high A and faced more age appropriate pitching. Like he was only 17 years old last year and he was just putting up absolute monster numbers. It is only the DSL, so we can't put too much stock into it yet. Anyone who was Benjamin Bailey stan back in the day would attest to that even if these guys are putting up massive numbers down there, it's not necessarily going to hold true once they come stateside. But this is a guy that's off to a massive start, and he's already cracking not just my top 30 list, but pretty much every White Sox top 30 list that you can find, he's on there. He is someone that can skyrocket up the rankings if he holds these numbers once he comes over and debuts in the Arizona League this sometime during the summer. But yeah, he's the guy that I'm going to be keeping an eye on because he's got a lot of upside and he could really shoot up the ranks if he can hold these numbers.
And you mentioned Mason Adams too, and just how different publications, different opinions, and how he's off your list, but could be there soon, but he's 19th at MLB Pipeline. I guess, is there a player you feel, whether it's higher or lower, that you have the most different opinion on than publications? Well, again, higher or lower, but just trying to get a sense of if you feel like, hey, there's this guy that I'm just not buying into yet, or this guy that I'm really buying into that people haven't caught up on, essentially.
So the guy that I am really buying into, and it's too bad Nick's not here because I know he loves this prospect too. Wilfred Varas is a guy that I'm really high on. And if we're going to keep the MLB pipeline comparisons going, they have him in the mid-20s. I have him at 10. I'm just a big fan. And again, this is also just kind of my style of evaluation. Goes back to his age versus the level of competition that he is playing. Guy, 20 years old, he made his debut in Double A, or he started off the year in High A and then eventually worked his way up to Double A. Had a 125 WRC plus in Double A at 20 years old, was mashing home runs, and he has even more raw power than he's shown in games. There are some real knocks on him. He's absolutely an over-aggressive hitter. Strikes out way too much and does not draw a lot of walks at all. So that is something he's going to have to work on. And I'm not saying that he's a clear-cut, can't-miss prospect either. Like, there is a ton of risk that comes with Wilfred Varas at the plate with his aggressiveness and also his defense, where he just made a transition. This is something that I personally give him a stock up for, because he, in 1 year, transitioned from a guy who couldn't cut it in the corner infield and was looked at as a DH-only type prospect to a guy who's not going to win any gold gloves, but was at least holding his own in right field last year, where he's got also a cannon of an arm that absolutely plays in right field. And being new to the position, he wasn't spectacular, but he at least looked like an outfielder. Now, I know there's going to be jokes about, the White Sox moving first baseman and corner infielders to right field, but at least they're starting the process sooner rather than later with Varas. And again, he's not going to be winning any Gold Glove awards, but he at least looked like he could belong out there. So that's one guy personally that I am very high on, that I know I'm higher on than the consensus, but he's someone that he is one of my guys for sure.
So, Michael, the biggest thing I've always really respected, and it's the reason why I really enjoy reading these articles from you, is you're able to contextualize what you see in players compared to just being able to stare at a stat sheet. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't really take the time to really pay attention to. You're able to see the difference between Tim Elko and a guy who might not put up the stats, but when he looks good in the league that he should be playing in, that's a lot more positive than a guy who should already be a major leaguer and is just mashing a triple A. So that's one thing I've always really liked about reading those. You're able to do it without, you know, I mean, everyone has their own bias, but you're very, very good at contextualizing why you feel a certain way about a guy and not being too focused on just the stats of why people love this guy compared to somebody who should actually be viewed as a higher prospect in the system. So definitely, I you know, just wanted to give you a little bit of praise there. But, you know, that, yeah, you know, Ohio State fan still. But that all being said, you know, we focus a lot on the players. And, you know, I don't think, you know, maybe you don't have to answer this based on how many guys on your top 30 are in one level or another. But what do you think, out of all the minor league teams in the White Sox system, what do you think, which one are you kind of excited to see? Which one has the most guys that you think really have a chance to show that there might be a little bit of a pipeline brewing in one of these areas of the system?
Yeah. So unfortunately we don't have the official minor league rosters yet, but we pretty much already know who's going to start at what levels. You know, I think, you know, we all know, like, Brian Ramos is starting in AAA. Colson Montgomery is probably going to start in AAA. AAA is probably the easy answer because of all the guys that, you know, we do have a lot of our top prospects are going to start there and could be on the major league roster soon. But I'm not going to go there. I'm actually going to go with, and they don't start until June, but I'm really excited to see our Arizona team, our Arizona Complex team. There's several prospects there, and I just touched on, I'm going to have to say his name again, Mogollon. I think I got it. But there's, along with him, there's other prospects there as well that I'm really excited to see what they do when they come stateside, because that is a big transition for a lot of these international prospects. Is a lot of them tear it up in the Dominican League and then they come stateside and they start to fizzle out. But there's a few high upside guys that we have that are going to be making their stateside debut this year. So along with Mogollon, we've got Abraham Nunez, who was our highest signed position player last year. And he slowed down a little bit as the season went on, but overall he had a really good professional debut year. You know, he showed a ton of great discipline at the plate, showed five tool ability. He's a guy with a lot of upside, and I we'll see if he can maintain it when he comes stateside, but he's a guy that I'm really excited about. Another guy, a catcher, Stephen Flores. You know, this was a guy who it took until the last month of the year for his batting average to finally come below 400 in the Dominican Summer League. I mean, his you know, bat to ball skills were tremendous at that level. Again, we'll see if he can sustain that when he comes stateside. And then Luis Reyes, who was the top-rated international prospect we signed last year, started off, I think his ERA was like in the 50s or something astronomical like that after the first couple appearances. And then he really started to, you know, calm things down and showed why he was a highly sought-after prospect with plus stuff, high-velocity fastball, good movement on his breaking pitches. He's a guy that hope we'll see if he can log more innings and get a little more consistent when he comes stateside. But that is a one pitching prospect with a lot of upside in this organization that I'm really excited to see. So there's a lot of unknown, but that's kind of what I'm excited about, is having that unknown, but having also that high upside at that level. That's why I'm really excited for June to come around when those complex leagues start up and see how some of these guys fare.
All right, Michael Suero, our top Sox on 35th prospect guy. Yeah. I don't know if you have an official title yet or if you prefer official title, but I'm going to call you the prospect guy. No, genuinely, always appreciate you having you on the podcast, buddy. Really looking forward to some of the stuff you do with the minor leagues this year. Ladies and gents, that's all we have this week for the Sox on 35th podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the pod on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcast. Also, be sure to check out the website, SoxOn35th.com, as well as following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SoxOn35th to stay up to date with your Chicago White Sox. We will be back next week, possibly next week. I don't know. We'll be back eventually. You know how that usually goes. As we cover another week of White Sox baseball. Thank you. And go Sox.
Go Sox.
I'm putting prospect Gaia on my LinkedIn, and go Sox.